In the years since Russian tanks crossed the border into eastern Ukraine in 2014, Ukraine has become a testing ground for Russian warfare and Russian hackers.
Hackers apparently breached government computer networks, looking for sensitive intelligence files.
But the first real blows hit in 2015, after a cyber military unit of Russia's armed forces called Sandworm hacked into dozens of Ukrainian governmental organizations and companies. Everything from media outlets to utility companies.
The Sandworm spies exploited a flaw in Microsoft Windows and used a common technique called spear phishing.
Sandworm used phishing attacks to trick people into downloading malware from mock emails. Later, this malware was used to destroy parts of the grid, leaving about 230,000 Ukrainians in the dark for up to 6 hours.
Russia appears to have figured out how to crash a power grid with a click.
The hackers cut the circuit breakers at nearly 60 substations.
And a year later, in 2016, they did it again.
Operators at the power grid were getting emails about a variety of different events going on in Ukraine. When they opened up the email, a piece of malware called Black Energy 3 was dropped to the system.
But that was nothing compared to what came next. In the spring of 2017, Sandworm used something called a supply chain attack to gain entry into thousands of computers around the country and the world. For a while, nothing happened. No one even knew they'd been hacked. But months later, after living quietly inside those computers, hackers released a piece of malware called NotPetya, scrambling systems worldwide.
The cyber weapon NotPetya started in Ukraine in June of 2017, quickly spread, paralyzing major companies and causing more than
$10 billion, by far the biggest cyber attack in history.
The attack crippled everything from hospitals in Pennsylvania to FedEx's European subsidiary TNT Express. It didn't just crash Ukraine. It crashed the world. And experts are saying something like it could happen again here in the U.S.
These same actors using similar capabilities and tradecraft are getting access to these business networks and getting access to portions of the power grid.
It might even be happening right now.
Russian government hackers are reportedly behind a months-long cyber attack targeting several U.S. agencies.
Solar winds. Apparently, it was much worse than first feared.
Could leave people without electricity for days or even weeks, according to experts. Because, ironically, America's advanced automated grid would be much harder to fix.
I'm Lacey Healy, and this is Things That Go Boom, your friendly neighborhood national security podcast. Today, we're going to talk about cyber war and what it might mean for us now.
Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes 3 times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine this. It's December. You're counting down the days to Christmas already, sitting at your computer, passively checking your email, when a standard alert pops up to ask if you've registered a new phone to your company's account. This is how the company FireEye first realized it had a problem.
So our understanding of the Solar Winds saga begins in early December of 2020, when the company FireEye noticed that it had been the victim of a cyber intrusion, and it posted the signatures of what had happened to it online.
Mika Ouyang is the senior vice president for the National Security Program at the organization Third Way, and she's been tracking how this incident played out.
As other companies began looking through their networks to identify these clues that FireEye had flagged, they discovered that they had also been the victims of a cyber intrusion.
About 18,000 companies, all of which were using the same software monitoring service, a platform called Orion, from the company SolarWinds.
SolarWinds is like the digital equivalent of security cameras in a physical building. It helps you monitor what's going on your network and with your network traffic. And it's widely used by both Fortune 500 companies and across the U.S. government.
It's also widely used by many of us, For example, in the Microsoft products we rely on. By gaining access to SolarWinds, hackers created a backdoor to those companies and federal agencies,
including the agency that controls America's nuclear weapons, the agency that controls and regulates the electric grid, the Department of Treasury that has a lot of sensitive financial information.
And how they did that was through something called a supply chain attack, which is a little complicated because if you're like me, you might assume that means the programming for this hack, it came in the box with the software, that someone had to tamper with the product, the physical supplies, before it arrived. But what actually happened is a lot more dangerous. The hackers behind SolarWinds managed to break into the developer update channel. So when companies and agencies thought they were just getting a legitimate update, they were actually downloading malicious code.
And that is one of the things that we worry about the most, because we update without even thinking about it. We turn on automatic updates and we trust that when that update happens, it comes from the manufacturer. And that's a really important thing, because most of the time that update is actually shutting down vulnerabilities that they have subsequently discovered after they ship to your software on your machine. So getting into that channel is actually a very sophisticated and very dangerous thing.
By breaking into that update channel, we now know that hackers were able to access Microsoft's source code, which is basically the architectural blueprint for how the software is built.
What that means is that the attackers may have seen the proprietary code that Microsoft has, which means that they might be able to engineer future attacks through the Microsoft products that we don't even know about yet. For everybody running Outlook, Word, Windows, Excel.
Potentially over a billion users.
And people are very concerned about this, because the Microsoft products are things that people all across the world and all across government use every day to communicate with each other, to draft sensitive documents, to, you know, write up what they're thinking and what their plans are for things.
Microsoft has been clear that this source code knowledge doesn't immediately mean users are at a heightened security risk. And it doesn't look like the hackers have gained access to customer data. But some experts have warned that just getting a look at the source code might be enough to engineer a future attack that could gain hackers access to that data. Wondering if this attack was actually just recon for the bigger threat to come. Microsoft's President Brad Smith called this a moment of reckoning in cybersecurity.
It's so sophisticated and its reach is so broad, and it is reckless because it put at risk the technology supply chain, frankly, for the global economy.
Even as President Trump downplayed the threat and attempted to shift blame to China. But in the days and weeks that have followed, the hack has come a lot more clearly into view, both in terms of how big it is and who's behind it.
In January of 2021, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the Director of National Intelligence, and the NSA issued a joint statement saying that they believe that this attack was likely Russia and that this is part of a very aggressive espionage campaign by the Russians to gain access, information, and potentially do harm on systems all over the world.
Since that time, investigators at a Moscow-based cybersecurity firm have revealed that the hack contained links to spying tools previously used by a group that operates on Russia's behalf. And they didn't just find one similarity, which might suggest a coincidence or even an attempt by someone else to pose as Russia. They found three. Which means, yeah, it was probably Russia. And it was probably espionage, which in and of itself is nothing new.
Cyber espionage has been increasing over the past 10 years, I would say. And we've seen it not just from the Russians, but from the Chinese, the Iranians. There are a lot of very sophisticated actors out there.
There are two types of cyber attacks. The kind where hackers are trying to get in to see something, the cyber espionage we were just talking about, and the kind where they're trying to get in to do something, like wreak havoc in Ukraine. And as of yet, we still don't know which this one is, which means we also don't exactly know how we should respond. Because espionage is something that all countries engage in, including the United States.
Because espionage is sort of in this weird gray space outside of the law, there aren't really rules about it. But in the real world, if we had caught a Russian agent on U.S. soil breaking into SolarWinds for this, we would prosecute that person for espionage. We send them back to their country, and then we say, you're not allowed to be here anymore. But we're not quite sure how to handle it in the digital space. The question then becomes, what is the appropriate way to hold people accountable for this kind of activity if they are in their home country?
Mika says that the exact definition of cyber warfare is still an ongoing debate.
People talk about a cyber 9/11, and there are a lot of people who are like, well, that's a really hyperbolic analogy. But if it is really the Russians, and they really pull off the kind of attack that has the impact on the U.S., it's like 9/11, and causes loss of life, if they say, shut down hospitals across America so that people in ICUs can no longer breathe on their ventilators, that is a very serious kinetic attack. That does rise to the level of an armed attack for which we might want to go to war.
The Trump years weren't strong on cyber enforcement. So much so that over 70% of cyber experts who responded to a poll by the Washington Post agreed that he failed to hold adversaries, including Russia, accountable for hacking U.S. targets.
The Trump administration failed to prioritize cybersecurity.
Removed experienced cyber defenders from their posts for petty reasons.
Breaking news out of the White House. President Trump has just fired Christopher Krebs.
And undermined much of the good work being done on cybersecurity within federal agencies.
By firing the top cybersecurity official who publicly contradicted Trump's false claims about voter fraud.
Mika says naming and shaming can help shrink the gray space that Russia loves to operate in, where malicious activity can't be attributed to them. That a return to more aggressive legal action could help make it crystal clear that we find this behavior unacceptable. And that's a message that Russia needs to hear.
They're like a nation gaslighting the rest of the world. Like, no, it wasn't me. I don't know what you're talking about. Right? They do that in the physical space. They do that in the cyberspace.
This form of legal action could have an impact because even beyond Trump, the consequences for cybercrime have historically been really minor.
Of the reported cybercrimes, only 3 in 1,000 see an arrest. We also know that cybercrime is the most prevalent form of crime in America, and 1 in 4 American households see an arrest. So the underreporting is like 1 out of every 100 cases maybe gets reported.
If 1 out of 100 cases gets reported and 3 out of 1,000 reported cases sees an arrest, the enforcement rate is effectively zero.
And if you're a cyber criminal, you're like, why not? We need to change that so people don't have to think twice about whether or not they're getting into the business. And that's something that you do to shrink the gray space. And that's something that hurts countries that engage the gray space more than it hurts countries that live in the light. And the U.S. is a country that, at its best, is living in the light.
Remember that incident that started in Ukraine at the top of the episode? One of the worst cyber attacks in history? Sandworm's members weren't charged or even officially named in connection with those attacks until this October, 3 years after the fact.
Assessing the damage of SolarWinds will probably take us months, if not years, to fully understand.
And that's scary, because this attack had access to every nightmare scenario that we worry about. The information contained in this one breach could be used to shake our confidence in the financial system. It could be used to mess with the electrical grid and leave us all in the dark. It could be used to steal millions of Americans' personal data. And we don't even know the full range of the breach. Thankfully, at this point, all of those consequences are still just the makings of a doomsday scenario. One it's now clear we're not prepared for. When we come back, we'll talk about how, in addition to prosecuting these crimes, we might prevent them from happening in the first place. In order to talk about preventing cybercrime, first we have to understand the lay of the land as it stands today.
I am Julia Rocafort. I'm the CEO and founder of Revolution Cyber.
Revolution Cyber's tagline is teaching the cyber mindset and transforming awareness. They're a full-service tech firm that does everything from cybersecurity awareness training to something called security culture and brand management. And Jules told me that there are three main things we should all be aware of. First,
one of the biggest attack vectors in cybersecurity is around people.
Even with the best technology, people are still people, and they can and will mess up.
And what a lot of the technology today is aiming to do is to reduce the ability for people to subjectively decide whether or not they follow cybersecurity best practice.
Second,
our ability to have transparency into technology allows us to predict, to prevent, and to respond quickly to attacks as they happen. So what you'll see is a heavy investment in artificial intelligence, in machine learning, and things like that that really start to close the gap and make it easier and quicker to see threats as they arise.
And third,
the most important thing is, are we patching our networks? Are we updating software? Are we training our cybersecurity workforce? And then more importantly, how are we leveraging the processes within the cybersecurity team to actually reduce the likelihood that there is a threat unknown to an organization?
So to recap, the biggest threat to cybersecurity is people. The better we understand technology, the better we'll be at preventing cyber attacks. And we need to keep our cyber networks and workforce up to date. Because governments and companies don't avoid a cyber attack by thinking about it here and there. Building this type of resilience is an ongoing effort, and it isn't easy. Jules says that in her experience, the single biggest thing that people don't understand about cybersecurity is that beyond revenue, beyond customer base, a cyber attack is the one thing that could completely destroy an organization.
That poses a huge vulnerability because you're not investing in the right areas to protect your organization, yet the hackers are aware that you're not doing that, and they're leveraging that against you.
But even with the best cyber hygiene, there's only so much you can do.
It is almost impossible to prevent an attack if you're being targeted directly by a nation state because they only have to be right once.
Think about that for a second. We can invest all we want, have all the best technology, and still, when it comes to attacks from Russia, China, and others, the truth is that one successful hack can sink it all. But Jules says we still have to try. And right now, when it comes to the government, it's actually bureaucracy that's holding us back.
Government procurement practices are not suitable for buying, acquiring, protecting vendors that are introduced to the environment.
Traditionally, government technology procurement, the systems they use to buy new tech, has taken too long, cost too much, and resulted in too many vulnerabilities. Slow replacement results in an overuse of the same legacy systems that become more difficult and more expensive to run over time.
Your ability to respond requires that you be well-funded, that you have the ability to make decisions on a dime, and that you have the ability to really drive the investment of time and resources in order to address things. Most organizations don't recognize that they don't have those things until the bad thing happens.
In 2019, the Government Accountability Office reported that of $90 billion spent that year on IT, most would go toward the maintenance of legacy systems, some of which are over 50 years old. Just take another second to imagine 50-year-old IT.
Right, keys in. Can you check this oil level, please, Harry?
Oil okay.
But Jules says that some things have begun to change. The government has put policies in place, for example, to speed the procurement process and create new terms and requirements for vendors.
So they've decreased the amount of time it takes to get into the government. They've put in more requirements in terms of what they expect. You have to demonstrate that you're updating your technology in a way that meets government standards.
The problem is that fixing all of the government's procurement troubles is a huge job. One that will require more than just incremental change.
So the way it operates won't be solved by creating a new law. It won't be changed by creating new regulation. In fact, what it requires is a wholesale rethinking and restructuring of the way in which government does business.
Jules says that right now there are measures being taken behind the scenes that indicate that we're doing everything we can to prevent any negative impacts of the SolarWinds attack. But some experts have argued that the only way to make sure we fully mitigate the impact of this attack is to get rid of every single computer in these federal agencies and start over again with fresh devices. Rebuild every network, which, when you're talking about the U.S. government, is a multi-billion dollar problem. One that the next administration will have to be prepared to address on day one. Of course, the new president will have a lot to grapple with in his first days and weeks.
After shattering another record for daily infections, tonight more Americans than ever are hospitalized with COVID. Across the nation, medical
centers... It's the storming of the Capitol. Trump supporters forcing their way into the halls of Congress.
Some of the most vicious and hateful things that we see on the internet often is factually inaccurate.
The first thing on the agenda of a new Biden administration is going to have to be turning attention to the very important arms control treaty that's about to expire on February the 5th.
The next 3 to 4 months are going to be worse than financial markets are braced for at the moment.
But Jules says that's okay. This isn't a problem we're going to solve easily. In fact, it could be years. And it's not one we can solve through leadership alone.
So my understanding of constitutional law says presidents do not change the government in of themselves. Mm. He will still be inheriting a bureaucracy designed not to solve things as quickly as we would like. It is always helpful when you have a new administration that is determined to address things in real time. That's what I think will be the difference, is that there'll be a concerted effort, but there still is a lack of understanding by the government about the impact of these cybersecurity attacks. So I don't expect it to completely unilaterally change.
The scary thing is just how much we still don't know and still can't do. Peeling back the layers of this attack, resetting and starting over if we have to, even coming to terms with the consequences we don't yet fully understand, will all take time. And in that time, we continue to be vulnerable to an attack. Welcome to 2021, everyone. Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. This episode was produced by Marin Lazian and me. It was edited by Ruth Morris, John Barth, and Layla Ujaili. Darian Shulman writes the music for our show, and Robin Wise takes each episode over the finish line. Thank you, as always, to the foundations that make our work possible, the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Cologne Foundation, Craig Newmark Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. And thank you to all of you for supporting our show. We've reached the end of our first ever fundraiser, and you all really, really came out. If you missed out on the chance, you can always go to inkstickmedia.com/donate to contribute anytime. But to those of you who already have, thank you. It really does make a huge difference, especially in such a hard time. We'll see you right back here in 2 weeks.
In December of 2020. It's like, so I'm like, oh, last year was 2019 because we're still in 2020 because shit is still terrible.